Having blew a long time to stare at the skull inside the helmet. This is the same as me telling you not to walk in front of a bus. Several comebacks riffled through Blue's head before she found one that she wanted. Why? Neve didn't see me on the corpse road. I'm not going to die in the next year. First of all, the corpse road is a promise, not a guarantee, Mora replied. Second of all, there are other terrible fates besides death. Shall we talk about dismemberment, paralysis, endless psychological trauma? There's something really wrong with those boys. When your mother says don't walk in front of a bus, she has a good reason. From the kitchen, Persephone's soft voice called,
If someone had stopped you from walking in front of a bus, Mora, Blue wouldn't be here.
Mora shot a frown in her direction, then swept her hand across the reading table as if she were clearing it of crumbs. The best case scenario here is that you make friends with a boy who is going to die. Ah, said Calla in a very, very knowing way. Now I see. Don't psychoanalyze me, her mother said. I already have, and I say again, ah. Mora sneered uncharacteristically and then asked Calla, What did you see when you touched that other boy, the Raven boy? They're all Raven boys, Blue said. Her mother shook her head. No, he's more Raven than the others. Calla rubbed her fingertips together as if she was wiping the memory of Ronan's tattoo from them.
It's like scrying into that weird space. There's so much coming out of him it shouldn't be possible. Do you remember that woman who came in who was pregnant with quadruplets? It was like that, but worse.
He's pregnant? Blue asked.
He's creating, Calla said. That space is creating, too. I don't know how to say it any better than that.
Blue wondered what sort of creating they meant. She was always creating things, taking old things and cutting them up and making them better things, taking things that already existed and transforming them into something else. This, she felt, was what most people meant when they called someone creative. But she suspected that wasn't how Calla meant it. She suspected that what Calla meant was the true meaning of creative, to make a thing where before there was none. Mora caught Blue's expression. She said, I've never told you to do anything before, Blue, but I'm telling you now, stay away from them. 16. The night following the reading, Gansey woke to a completely unfamiliar sound and fumbled for his glasses. It sounded a little like one of his roommates was being killed by a possum, or possibly the final moments of a fatal catfight. He wasn't certain of the specifics, but he was sure death was involved. Noah stood in the doorway to his room, his face pathetic and long-suffering. Make it stop, he said. Ronan's room was sacred, and yet here Gansey was, twice in the same week, pushing the door open. He found the lamp on, and Ronan hunched on the bed, wearing only boxers. 6 months before, Ronan had gotten the intricate black tattoo that covered most of his back and snaked up his neck, and now the monochromatic lines of it were stark in the claustrophobic lamplight, more real than anything else in the room. It was a peculiar tattoo, both vicious and lovely, and every time Gansey saw it, he saw something different in the pattern. Tonight, nestled in an inked glen of wicked, beautiful flowers, was a beak, where before he'd seen a scythe. The ragged sound cut through the apartment again. What fresh hell is this? Gansey asked pleasantly. Ronan was wearing headphones as usual, so Gansey stretched forward far enough to tug them down around his neck. Music wailed faintly into the air. Ronan lifted his head. As he did, the wicked flowers on his back shifted and hid behind his sharp shoulder blades. In his lap was the half-formed raven, its head tilted back, beak agape. I thought we were clear on what a closed door meant, Ronan said. He held a pair of tweezers in one hand. I thought we were clear that night was for sleeping. Ronan shrugged. Perhaps for you. Not tonight. Your pterodactyl woke me. Why is it making that sound? In response, Ronan dipped the tweezers into a plastic baggie on the blanket in front of him. Gansey wasn't certain he wanted to know what the gray substance was in the tweezers' grasp. As soon as the raven heard the rustle of the bag, it made the ghastly sound again, a rasping squeal that became a gurgle as it slurped down the offering. At once, it inspired both Gansey's compassion and his gag reflex. "Well, this is not going to do," he said. "You're going to have to make it stop."
"She has to be fed," Ronan replied.
The raven gargled down another bite. This time it sounded a lot like vacuuming potato salad.
"It's only every 2 hours for the first 6 weeks. Can't you keep her downstairs?"
In reply, Ronan half lifted the little bird toward him.
"You tell me."
Gansey disliked having his kindness appealed to, especially when it had to war with his desire for sleep. There was, of course, no way that he would force the raven downstairs. It looked bite-sized and improbable. He wasn't certain if it was extremely cute or appallingly ugly, and it bothered him that it managed to be both. From behind him, Noah said, sounding pitiful, "I don't like that thing in here. It reminds me of..." He trailed off, as he often did, and Ronan pointed the tweezers at him.
"Hey, man, stay out of my room."
"Shut up," Gansey told both of them. "That includes you, bird."
"Chainsaw."
Noah withdrew, but Gansey remained. For several minutes, he watched the raven slurp down gray slime while Ronan cooed at her. He was not the Ronan that Gansey had grown accustomed to, but neither was he the Ronan that Gansey had first met. It was clear now that the instrument wailing from the headphones was the Irish pipes. Gansey couldn't remember the last time Ronan had listened to Celtic music, Neil Lynch's music. All at once, he too missed Ronan's charismatic father. But more than that, he missed the Ronan that had existed when Neil Lynch had still been alive. This boy in front of him now, fragile bird in his hands, seemed like a compromise. After a space, Gansey asked, "What did the psychic mean, Ronan, earlier, about your father?" Ronan didn't lift his head, but Gansey watched the muscles in his back tighten, stretched as if they were suddenly carrying weight.
"That's a very Declan question."
Gansey considered this.
No, I don't think it is."
"She was just full of shit."
Gansey considered this too.
"No, I don't think she was."
Ronan found his music player next to him on the bed and paused it. When he replied, his voice was pitchless and naked.
"She's one of those chicks who gets inside your head and fucks around with parts. She said it because she knew it would cause problems."
"Like what?"
"Like you asking me questions like Declan would," Ronan said.
He offered the raven another gray mass, but she just stared up at him, transfixed,
"making me think about things I don't want to think about. Those sorts of problems, among others. What's going on with your face, by the way?"
Gansey rubbed his chin, rueful. His skin felt reluctantly stubbled. He knew he was being diverted, but he allowed it.
"Is it growing?" "Dude, you aren't really going to do that beard thing, are you? I thought you were joking. You know that stopped being cool in the 14th century or whenever it was that Paul Bunyan lived."
Ronan looked over his shoulder at him. He was sporting the 5 o'clock shadow that he was capable of growing at any time of the day.
"Just stop. You look mangy."
"It's irrelevant. It's not growing. I'm doomed to be a man-child."
"If you keep saying things like man-child, we're done," Ronan said.
"Hey, man, don't let it get you down. Once your balls drop, that beard'll come in great, like a fucking rug. You eat soup, it'll filter out the potatoes, terrier style. Do you have hair on your legs? I've never noticed."
Gansey didn't dignify any of this with a response. With a sigh, he pushed off the wall and pointed at the raven. "I'm going back to bed. Keep that thing quiet. You so owe me, Lynch."
"Whatever," Ronan said.
Gansey retreated to his bed, though he didn't lie down. He reached for his journal, but it wasn't there. He'd left it at Nino's the night of the fight. He thought about calling Mallory, but he didn't know what he wanted to ask. Something inside him felt like the night, hungry and wanting and black. He thought about the dark eye holes of the skeletal knight on the death card. An insect was buzzing against the window, the sort of buzz tap that came from an insect with some size to it. He thought about his EpiPen, far away in the glove box of the car, too far away to be a useful antidote if it was needed. The insect was probably a fly or a stink bug or yet another crane fly, but the longer he lay there, the more he considered the idea that it could be a wasp or a bee. It probably wasn't. But he opened his eyes. Gansey climbed softly from the bed, bending to retrieve a shoe that lay on its side. Walking cautiously to the window, he searched for the sound of the insect. The shadow of the telescope was an elegant monster on the floor beside him. Though the sound of buzzing had died away, it only took him a moment to find the insect on the window. A wasp, crawling up the narrow wooden frame of the window, swiveling back and forth. Gansey didn't move. He watched it climb and pause. The street lights outside made a faint shadow of its legs, its curved body, the fine, insubstantial point of the stinger. Two narratives coexisted in his head. One was the real image, the wasp climbing up the wood, oblivious to his presence. The other was a false image, a possibility. The wasp whirring into the air, finding Gansey's skin, dipping the stinger into him. Gansey's allergy, making it a deadly weapon. Long ago, his skin had crawled with hornets, their wings beating even when his heart hadn't. His throat was tight and full. Gansey. Ronan's voice was just behind him. The timbre of it strange and initially unrecognizable. Gansey didn't turn around. The wasp had just twitched its wings, nearly lifting off. "Shit, man," Ronan said. There were three footsteps very close together, the floor creaking like a shot, and then the shoe was snatched from Gansey's hand. Ronan shoved him aside and brought down the shoe on the window so hard that the glass should have broken. After the wasp's dry body had fallen to the floorboard, Ronan sought it out in the darkness and smashed it once more. "Shit," Ronan said again. "Are you stupid?" Gansey didn't know how to describe how it felt to see death crawling inches from him, to know that in a few seconds he could have gone from a promising student to beyond saving. He turned to Ronan, who had painstakingly picked up the wasp by a broken wing so that Gansey wouldn't step on it. "What did you want?" he asked. "What?" Ronan demanded. "You came out for something." Ronan chucked the wasp's small body into the wastebasket by the desk. The trash was overflowing with crumpled papers, so the body bounced out and forced him to find a better crevice for it. "I can't even remember." Gansey merely stood and waited for Ronan to say something else. Ronan fussed over the wasp for another few moments before he said anything, and when he finally did, he didn't look at Gansey. "What's this about you and Parrish leaving?" It wasn't what Gansey had expected. He wasn't sure how to speak without hurting Ronan. He couldn't lie to him. "You tell me what you heard, and I'll tell you what's real." "Noah told me," Ronan said, "that if you left, Parrish was going with you." He had let jealousy sneak into his voice, and that made Gansey's response cooler than it might have been. Gansey tried not to play favorites. "And what else did Noah have to say?" With visible effort, Ronan pulled himself back, sorted himself out. None of the Lynch brothers liked to appear anything other than intentional, even if it was intentionally cruel. Instead of answering, he asked, "Do you not want me to come?" Something stuck in Gansey's chest. "I would take all of you anywhere with me." The moonlight made a strange sculpture of Ronan's face, a stark portrait incompletely molded by a sculptor who had forgotten to work in compassion. He did his smoker's inhale, heavy on the intake through the nostrils, light on the exhale through his prison of teeth. After a pause, he said, "The other night, there's something." But then he stopped without saying anything else. It was a full stop, the sort that Gansey associated with secrets and guilt. It was the stop that happened when you'd made up your mind to confess, but your mouth betrayed you in the end. "There's what?" Ronan muttered something. He shook the wastebasket. "There's what, Ronan?" he said. "This thing with Chainsaw and the psychic woman and just with Noah
and I just think there's something strange going on.
Gansey couldn't keep the exasperation from his voice.
Strange doesn't help me. I don't know what strange means.
I don't know, man. This sounds crazy to me. I don't know what to tell you.
I mean strange like your voice on that recorder, Ronan replied. Strange like the psychic's daughter. Things feel bigger. I don't know what I'm saying. I thought you would believe me of all people.
I don't even know what you're asking me to believe.
Ronan said, it's starting, man.
Gansey crossed his arms.
He could see the dark black wing of the dead wasp pressed against the mesh of the wastebasket. He waited for Ronan to elaborate, but all the other boy said was,
I catch you staring at a wasp again, though. I'm going to let it kill you. Screw that.
Without waiting for a reply, he turned away and retreated back to his room.
Slowly, Gansey picked up his shoe from where Ronan had left it. When he straightened, he realized Noah had drifted from his room to stand near Gansey. His anxious gaze flickered from Gansey to the wastebasket. The wasp's body had slipped down several inches, but it was still visible.
What? Gansey asked.
Something about Noah's uneasy face reminded him of the frightened faces surrounding him. Hornets on his skin, the sky blue as death above him. A long, long time ago, he'd been given another chance, and lately, the weight of needing to make it matter felt heavier. He looked away from Noah out the wall of window panes. Even now, it seemed to Gansey that he could feel the aching presence of the nearby mountains, like the space between him and the peaks was a tangible thing. It was as excruciating as the imagined sleeping countenance of Glendower.
Ronan was right. Things felt bigger. He may not have found the line or the heart of the line, but something was happening. Something was starting.
Noah said, don't throw it away.
17. Several days later, Blue woke up sometime well before dawn. Her room was cluttered with jagged shadows from the hall nightlight. As they had every night since the reading, thoughts about Adam's elegant features and the memory of Gansey's bowed head crowded into her mind as soon as sleep relinquished its hold. Blue couldn't help replaying the chaotic episode over and over in her mind. Kala's volatile response to Ronan, Adam and Gansey's private language, the fact that Gansey was not just a spirit on the corpse road. But it wasn't just the boys that she was concerned with, though sadly it didn't seem likely that Adam would ever call now. No, the thing that seized her the most was the idea that her mother had forbidden her to do something. It pinched like a collar. Blue pushed off the covers. She was getting up. She bore a grudging fondness for the weird architecture of 300 Fox Way. It was a sort of half-hearted affection born of nostalgia more than any real feeling. But her feelings for the yard behind the house were anything but mixed. A great spreading beech tree sheltered the entire backyard. Its beautiful, perfectly symmetrical canopy stretched from one fence line to the other, so dense that it tinted even the hottest summer day a lush green. Only the heaviest rain could penetrate the leaves. Blue had a satchel full of memories of standing by the massive, smooth trunk in the rain, hearing it hiss and tap and scatter across the canopy without ever reaching the ground. Standing under the beech tree, it felt like she was the beech, like the rain rolled off her leaves and off the bark, smooth as skin against her own. With a little sigh, Blue made her way down to the kitchen. She pushed open the back door using two hands to close it silently behind her. After dark, the yard was its own world, private and dim. The high wooden fence covered with messy honeysuckle blocked out the lights from neighboring back porches, and the inscrutable canopy of the beech blocked the moonlight. Ordinarily, she would have had to wait several long minutes for her eyes to adjust to the relative dark, but not tonight. Tonight, an eerie, uncertain light flickered on the trunk of the tree. Blue hesitated just outside the door, trying to make sense of the sputtering light as it shifted on the pale gray bark. Laying a hand against the side of the house, it was still warm from the heat of the day. She leaned forward. From here, she saw a candle around the other side of the tree, nestled in the bare snake roots of the beach. A tremulous flame vanished and lengthened and vanished again. Blue took a step off the cracked brick patio, then another, glancing behind her again to see if anyone watched from the house. Whose project was this? A few feet away from the candle was another tangle of smooth-skinned roots, and a pool of black water had gathered in them. The water reflected the flickering light, like another candle beneath the black surface. Blue held her breath tight inside her as she took another step. In a loose sweater and broom skirt, Neve knelt near the candle and the little root pool. With her pretty hands folded in her lap, she was as motionless as the tree itself and as dark as the sky overhead. Blue's breath came out in a rush when she first saw Neve, and then lifting her eyes to Neve's barely visible face, her breath jerked out of her once more, as if the surprise were fresh again. "Oh," Blue breathed, "I'm sorry, I didn't know you were here." But Neve didn't reply. When Blue looked closer, she saw that Neve's eyes were unfocused. It was her eyebrows that really did it for Blue. They had no expression to them somehow. Even more vacuous than Neve's eyes were those formless eyebrows, waiting for input, drawn in two straight neutral lines. Blue's first thought was something medical. Weren't there seizures where the symptom was just sitting there? What were those called? But then she thought of the bowl of cran grape juice on the kitchen table. It was far more likely that she'd interrupted some sort of meditation. But it didn't look like meditation. It looked like a ritual. Her mother didn't do rituals. Mora had once told a client hotly, "I am not a witch." And once she had said sadly to Persephone, "I am not a witch." But perhaps Neve was. Blue wasn't certain what the rules were in this situation. "Who's there?" asked Neve. But it was not Neve's voice. It was something deeper and farther away. A nasty little shiver ran up Blue's arms. Somewhere in the tree above, a bird hissed. At least Blue thought it was a bird. "Come into the light," said Neve. The water moved in the roots, or maybe it was merely the moving reflection of the solitary candle. As Blue cast her gaze wider, she saw a five-pointed star marked around the beech tree. One point was the candle, and another the pool of dark water. An unlit candle marked the third point, and an empty bowl the fourth. For a moment, Blue thought that she was mistaken, that it was not a five-pointed star after all. But then she realized Neve was the final point. "I know you are there," Not Neve said, in the voice that sounded like dark places, far away from the sun. "I can smell you." Something crawled very slowly up the back of Blue's neck on the inside of her skin. It was such a hideously real creep that she was badly tempted to slap it or scratch it. She wanted to go inside and pretend she had not come out, but she didn't want to leave Neve behind if something... Blue didn't want to think it, but she did. She didn't want to leave Neve behind if something had her. "I am here," Blue said. The candle flame stretched very, very long. Not Neve asked, "What is your name?" It occurred to Blue that she wasn't exactly certain that Neve's mouth moved when she spoke. It was hard to look at her face. "Neve," Blue lied, "come where I can see you." There was definitely something moving in the little black pool. The water was reflecting colors that were not in the candle. They shifted and moved in a pattern completely unlike the movement of the flame. Blue shivered. "I am invisible." Sighed Not Neve. "Who are you?" Blue asked. The candle flame reached tall, tall, thin to the point of breaking. It reached not for the sky, but for Blue. "Neve," said Not Neve. There was something crafty now to the dark voice,
Something knowing and malicious. Something that made Blue want to look over her shoulder. But she couldn't look away from that candle because she was afraid the flame would touch her if she turned away.
"Where are you?" Blue asked.
"On the corpse road," Not Neve growled.
Blue became aware that her breath clouded in front of her. Goosebumps pricked her arms, fast and painful. In the half-light of the candle, she saw that Neve's breath was visible, too. The cloud of Neve's breath parted over the pool like something physical was rising from the water to break the path of it. Rushing forward, Blue kicked over the empty bowl, knocked over the unlit candle, scuffed dirt in the direction of the black pool. The candle went out. There was a minute of complete blackness. There was no sound, as if the tree and the yard around it were not in Henrietta anymore. Despite the silence, Blue did not feel alone, and it was a terrible feeling. "I am inside a bubble," she thought furiously. "I am in a fortress. There is glass all around me. I can see out, but nothing can get in. I am untouchable." All of the visuals that Mora had given her to protect herself from psychic attack, it felt like nothing at all against the voice that had come out of Neve. But then there was nothing. Her goosebumps had disappeared as quickly as they'd come. Slowly her eyes adjusted to the darkness, though it felt like light leeching back into the world, and she found Neve still kneeling by the pool of water.
"Neve,"
whispered Blue. For a moment nothing happened, and then Neve lifted her chin and her hands. "Please be Neve, please be Neve." Blue's entire body was poised to run. Then she saw that Neve's eyebrows were ordered and firm over her eyes, though her hands were quivering. Blue let out a relieved sigh.
"Blue?"
Neve asked. Her voice was quite normal. Then with sudden understanding,
"Oh, you won't tell your mother about this, will you?"
Blue stared at her.
"I most certainly will. What was that? What were you doing?"
Her heart was still going fast, and she realized that she was terrified now that she could think about it. Neve took in the broken pentagram, the knocked-over candle, the overturned bowl.
"I was scrying."
Her mild voice only infuriated Blue.
"Scrying is what you did earlier. This was not the same thing."
"I was scrying into that space I saw earlier. I was hoping to make contact with someone who was in it to find out what it was." Blue's voice was not nearly as steady as she would have liked.
"It spoke. It was not you when I came out here."
"Well," Neve said, sounding a little cross, "that was your fault. You make everything stronger. I wasn't expecting you to be here, or I would have..." She trailed off and looked at the stub of the candle, her head cocked. It wasn't a particularly human sort of gesture, and it made Blue remember the nasty chill she had gotten before.
"Would have what?" Blue demanded. She was a little cross, too, that she was somehow being blamed for whatever had just happened. "What was that? It said it was on the corpse road. Is that the same thing as a ley line?"
"Of course," Neve said. "Henrietta's on a ley line." That meant that Gansey was right. It also meant Blue knew exactly where the ley line ran because she'd seen Gansey's spirit walk along it only a few days earlier. "It's why it's easy to be a psychic here," Neve said. "The energy is strong."
"Energy? Like my energy?"
Blue asked. Neve did a complicated hand gesture before picking up the candle. She held it upside down in front of her and pinched the wick to be certain it was entirely extinguished.
"Energy like your energy. Feeds things. How did you put it? Makes the conversation louder. The light bulb brighter. Everything that needs energy to stay alive craves it, just like they crave your energy."
"What did you see," Blue asked, "when you were..."
"Scrying," Neve finished for her, though Blue wasn't at all certain that was how she would have finished it. "There's someone who knows your name there, and there's someone else who is looking for this thing that you're looking for."
"That I'm looking for?" Blue echoed, dismayed. There was nothing she was looking for, unless Neve was talking about the mysterious Glendower. She recalled that feeling of connection,
of feeling tied up in this web of raven boys and sleeping kings and ley lines, of her mother saying to stay away from them.
Yes, you know what it is, Neve replied. Ah, everything seems so much clearer now.
Blue thought about that stretching, hungry candle flame, the shifting lights inside the pool of water. She felt cold somewhere very deep inside her.
You haven't said what that was yet, in the pool.
Neve looked up then, all of her supplies gathered in her arms. Her gaze was the unbreakable one that could last an eternity.
That's because I have no idea, she said.
18. Welk took the liberty of going through Gansey's locker before school the next day. Gansey's locker, one of the few in use, was only a couple doors down from Welk's old one, and the feeling of opening it brought back a rush of memory and nostalgia. Once upon a time, this had been him, one of the wealthiest kids at Aglinby, with whichever friends he wanted, whichever Henrietta girls caught his eye, whichever classes he felt like going to. His father had no compunction about making an extra donation here or there to help Welk pass a class he'd failed to attend for a few weeks. Welk longed for his old car. The cops here had known his father well. They hadn't even bothered to pull Welk over. And now Gansey was a king here, and he didn't even know how to use it. Thanks to Aglinby's honor code, there were no locks on any of the lockers, allowing Welk to open Gansey's without any fuss. Inside, he found several dusty spiral-bound notebooks, with only a few pages used in each. In case Gansey decided to come into school 2 hours early, Welk left a note in the locker. Belongings have been removed while we spray for roaches, and then retreated back to one of the unused staff bathrooms to examine his find. Sitting cross-legged on the pristine but dusty tile beside the sink, what he found was that Richard Gansey III was more obsessed with the ley line than he had ever been. Something about the entire research process seemed frantic. What is wrong with this kid? Welk wondered, and then immediately afterward felt strange that he had grown old enough to think of Gansey as a kid. Outside the bathroom, he heard heels clicking down the hallway. The scent of coffee drifted under the doorway. Aglinby was beginning to stir. Welk flipped to the next notebook. This one was not about the ley line. It was all historical stuff about the Welsh king, Owen Glendower. Welk was not interested. He skimmed, 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 thinking it was unrelated, until he realized the case Gansey was making for tying the two elements together. Glendower and the ley line. Stooge or not, Gansey knew how to sell a story. Welk focused on one line. Whoever wakes Glendower is granted a favor. Limitless? Supernatural? Some sources say reciprocal. What does that mean? Cherney had never cared about the ultimate outcome of the ley line search. At first, Welk hadn't either. The appeal had merely been the riddle of it. Then one afternoon, Cherney and Welk standing in the middle of what seemed to be a naturally formed circle of magnetically charged stones had experimentally pushed one of the stones out of place. The resulting sizzle of energy had knocked them both off their feet and created a faint apparition of what looked like a woman. The ley line was raw, uncontrollable, inexplicable energy. The stuff of legends. Whoever controlled the ley line would be more than rich. Whoever controlled the ley line would be something that the other Aglinby boys could only hope to aspire to. Cherney still hadn't cared, not really. He was the most mild, ambitionless creature Welk had ever seen, which was probably why Welk liked to hang out with him so much. Cherney didn't have a problem being no better than the other Aglinby students. He was content to trot along after Welk. These days, when Welk was trying to comfort himself, he told himself that Cherney was a sheep, but sometimes he slipped and remembered him as loyal instead. They didn't have to be different things, did they? Glendower, Welk said out loud, trying it out.
The word echoed off the bathroom walls, hollow and metallic. He wondered what Gansey, strange, desperate Gansey, was thinking he'd ask for as a favor. Climbing up off the bathroom floor, Welk picked up all the notebooks. It would only take a few minutes to copy them in the staff room, and if anyone asked, he'd tell them Gansey had asked him to. Glindower. If Welk found him, he'd ask for what he'd wanted all along, to control the ley line.
19. The following afternoon, Blue walked barefoot to the street in front of 300 Fox Way and sat on the curb to wait for Calla beneath the blue-green trees. All afternoon, Neve had been locked up in her room, and Maura had been doing angel card readings for a group of out-of-towners on a writing retreat. So Blue had taken all afternoon to contemplate what to do about finding Neve in the backyard. And what to do involved Calla. She was just getting restless when Calla's carpool pulled up at the curb.
"Are you putting yourself out with the trash?" Calla asked as she climbed out of the vehicle, which was blue-green like everything else in the day. She wore a strangely respectable dress with dubiously funky rhinestone sandals. Making a lackadaisical hand motion at the driver, she turned to Blue as the car drove away.
"I need to ask you a question," Blue said.
"And it's a question that sounds better next to a trash can? Hold this."
Calla wrestled one of her bags off her arm and onto Blue's. She smelled of jasmine and chili peppers, which meant she'd had a bad day at work. Blue wasn't entirely certain what Calla did for a living, but she knew it had something to do with Aglinby, paperwork, and cursing at students, often on weekends. Whatever her job description was, it involved rewarding herself with burritos on bad days. Calla began to stomp up the walk toward the front door. Blue trailed helplessly after her, lugging the bag. It felt like it had books or bodies in it. "The house is full." Only one of Calla's eyebrows was paying any attention. "It's always full." They were nearly at the front door. Inside every room was occupied with aunts and cousins and mothers. The sound of Persephone's angry PhD music was already audible. The only chance for privacy was outside. Blue said, "I want to know why Neve's here." Calla stopped. She looked at Blue over her shoulder. "Well, excuse you," she replied, not very pleasantly. "I'd like to know the cause of climate change, too, but no one's telling me that." Clutching Calla's bag like a hostage, Blue insisted, "I'm not six anymore. Maybe everyone else can see what they need to see in a pack of cards, but I'm tired of being left in the dark." Now she had both of Calla's eyebrows interest. "Damn straight," Calla agreed. "I wondered when you were going to go all rebellious on us. Why aren't you asking your mother?" "Because I'm angry at her for telling me what to do." Calla shifted her weight.
"Take another bag. What is it you propose?"
Blue accepted another bag. This one was dark brown and managed to have corners. There seemed to be a box in it.
"That you just tell me?"
Using one of her newly freed hands, Calla tapped a finger on her lip. Both her lips and the nail she used to tap were deeply indigo, the color of octopus ink, the color of the deepest shadows in the rocky front yard.
"The only thing is, I'm not sure that what we've been told is the truth."
Blue felt a little lurch at that. The idea of lying to Calla or Maura or Persephone seemed ludicrous. Even if they didn't know the truth, they'd hear a lie. But there did seem to be something secretive about Neve, about her scrying after hours, where she thought it likely no one would see her.
Calla said, "She was supposed to be here looking for someone."
"My father," Blue guessed.
Calla didn't say yes, but she didn't say no either. Instead, she replied, "But I think it's become something else for her, now that she's been here in Henrietta for a while."
They regarded each other for a moment, co-conspirators. "My proposition is different then," Blue said finally. She tried to arch her eyebrow to match Calla's, but it felt a bit lacking. "We go through Neve's stuff. You hold it, and I'll stand next to you." Calla's mouth became very small. Her psychometric reflections were often vague, but with Blue beside her, making her gift stronger? It had certainly been dramatic when she touched Ronan's tattoo. If she handled Neve's things, they might get some concrete answers.
"Take this bag," Calla said, handing Blue the last of them. This one was the smallest of all, made of blood-red leather. It was impossibly heavy. While Blue worked out how to hold it with the others, Calla crossed her arms and tapped her indigo-nailed fingers on her upper arms.
"She'd have to be out of her room for at least an hour," Calla said, "and Mora would have to be otherwise occupied."
Calla had once observed that Mora had no pets because her principles took too much time to take care of. Mora was a big believer in many things, one of them personal privacy.
"But you will do it?"
"I'll find out more today," Calla said, "about their schedules."
"What's this?" Her attention had shifted to a car pulling up at the end of the walk. Both Calla and Blue tilted their heads to read the magnetic sign on the passenger door. "Flowers by Andy." The driver rummaged in the back seat of her car for a full 2 minutes before heading up the walk with the world's smallest flower arrangement. Her fluffed bangs were larger than the flowers.
"It's hard to find this place," the woman said.
Calla pursed her lips. She had a pure and fiery hatred for anything that could be classified as small talk.
"What's all this?" Calla asked. She made it sound as if the flowers were an unwanted kitten.
"This is for..." The woman fumbled for a card.
"Orla," guessed Blue.
Orla was always getting sent flowers by various lovelorn men from Henrietta and beyond. It wasn't just flowers they sent. Some sent spa packages, others sent fruit baskets. One, memorably, sent an oil portrait of Orla. He'd painted her in profile so that the viewer could fully see Orla's long, elegant neck, her classic cheekbones, her romantic, heavy-lidded eyes, and her massive nose, her least favorite feature. Orla had broken up with him immediately.
"Blue?" the woman asked. "Blue Sergeant?"
At first, Blue didn't understand that she meant that the flowers were for her. The woman had to thrust them toward her, and then Calla had to take back one of her bags in order for Blue to be able to accept them. As the woman headed back to her car, Blue turned the arrangement in her hand. It was just a spray of baby's breath around a white carnation. They smelled prettier than they looked.
Calla commented, "The delivery must have cost more than the flowers."
Feeling around the wiry stems, Blue found a little card. Inside, a woman's scrawl had transcribed a message.
"I hope you still want me to call.
Adam." Now the tiny bunch of flowers made sense. They matched Adam's frayed sweater.
"And you're blushing," Calla said disapprovingly. She held a hand out for them, which Blue smacked. With sarcasm, Calla added, "Whoever it is went all out, did they?"
Blue touched the edge of the white carnation to her chin. It was so light that it didn't feel like she was touching anything at all. It was no portrait or fruit basket, but she couldn't imagine Adam sending anything more dramatic. These little flowers were quiet and sparse, just like him. "I think they're pretty." She had to bite her lip to keep a foolish smile inside. What she wanted to do was hug the flowers and then dance, but both seemed insensible.
"Who is he?" asked Calla.
"I'm being secretive. Take your bags back."
Blue stretched out her arm so that Calla's brown bag and canvas bag slid down to Calla's open hands. Calla shook her head, but she didn't look displeased. Deep down, Blue suspected she was a romantic.
"Calla," Blue asked, "do you think I should tell the boys where the Corpse Road is?"
Calla gazed at Blue for as long as a Neve gaze. Then she said,
"What makes you think I can answer that question?"
"Because you're an adult," Blue replied, "and you're supposed to have learned things on your way to old age."
"What I think," Calla said, "is that you've already made up your mind."
Blue dropped her eyes to the ground. It was true that she was kept awake at night by Gansey's journal and by the suggestion of something more
to the world. It was also true that she was dogged by the idea that maybe, just maybe, there was a sleeping king, and she would be able to lay her hand on his sleeping cheek and feel a centuries-old pulse beneath his skin. But more important than either of those was her face on that page of Cup's card, a boy's rain-spattered shoulders in the churchyard, and a voice saying, "Gansey, that's all there is." Once she'd seen his death laid out for him, and seen that he was real, and found out that she was meant to have a part in it, there had never been a chance she would just stand by and let it happen. "Don't tell Mom," Blue said. With a non-committal grunt, Calla wrenched open the door, leaving Blue and her flowers on the step. The blossoms weighed nothing at all, but to Blue, they felt like change. "Today," Blue thought, "is the day I stop listening to the future and start living it instead."
"Blue, if you get to know him," Calla started. She was standing half in, half out of the doorway. "You'd better guard your heart. Don't forget that he's going to die."
20. At the same time that his flowers were being delivered to 300 Fox Way, Adam arrived at Monmouth Manufacturing on his somewhat pathetic bicycle. Ronan and Noah were already out in the overgrown lot, building wooden ramps for some unholy purpose. He tried twice to persuade his rusted kickstand to hold his bike up before laying it down on its side. Crabgrass poked up through the spokes. He asked, "When do you think Gansey will get here?" Ronan didn't immediately answer him. He was lying as far beneath the BMW as he could, measuring the width of the tires with a yellow hardware store ruler. 10 inches, Noah. Noah, standing next to a pile of plywood and 4x4s, asked, "Is that all? That doesn't seem like very much."
"Would I lie to you? 10 inches.
Ronan shoved himself from beneath the car and stared up at Adam. He'd let his 5 o'clock shadow become a multi-day shadow, probably despite Gansey's inability to grow facial hair. Now he looked like the sort of person women would hide their purses and babies from.
"Who knows? When did he say?"
3. Ronan climbed to his feet and they both turned to watch Noah working with the plywood for the ramps. Working with really meant staring at. Noah had his fingers held 10 inches apart and he looked through the space between them to the wood below, perplexed. There were no tools in sight. "What is your plan with these things anyway?" Adam asked. Ronan smiled his lizard smile.
"Ramp, BMW, the goddamn moon."
This was so like Ronan. His room inside Monmouth was filled with expensive toys, but like a spoiled child, he ended up playing outside with sticks.
"The trajectory you're building doesn't suggest the moon," Adam replied. "It suggests the end of your suspension." "I don't need your back talk, science guy."
He probably didn't. Ronan didn't need physics. He could intimidate even a piece of plywood into doing what he wanted. Crouching by his bike, Adam messed over the kickstand again, trying to see if he could pry it free without breaking it entirely.
"What's your malfunction anyway?" Ronan asked.
"I'm trying to decide when I should call Blue."
Saying it out loud was inviting ridicule from Ronan, but it was one of those facts that needed to be acknowledged. Noah said,
"He sent her flowers."
"How did you know?" Adam demanded, more mortified than curious. Noah merely smiled in a far-off way. He kicked one of the wooden boards off the plywood, looking triumphant.
"To the psychics? You know what that place was?" Ronan asked. "A castration palace. You date that girl, you should send her your nuts instead of flowers."
"You're a Neanderthal."
"Sometimes you sound just like Gansey," Ronan said.
"Sometimes you don't."
Noah laughed his breathy, nearly soundless laugh. Ronan spit on the ground beside the BMW.
"I didn't even realize that midget was the Adam Parrish type," he said.
He wasn't being serious, but Adam was all at once fatigued with Ronan and his uselessness.
Since the day of the fistfight at Nino's, Ronan had already gotten several notices in his student box at Aglinby, warning him of the dire things slated to befall him if he didn't begin to improve his grades. If he didn't begin attempting to get grades. Instead, Ronan was out here building ramps. Some people envied Ronan's money. Adam envied his time. To be as rich as Ronan was to be able to go to school and do nothing else, to have luxurious swaths of time in which to study and write papers and sleep. Adam wouldn't admit it to anyone, least of all Gansey, but he was tired. He was tired of squeezing homework in between his part-time jobs, of squeezing in sleep, squeezing in the hunt for Glendower. The jobs felt like so much wasted time. In 5 years, no one would care if he'd worked at a trailer factory. They'd only care if he'd graduated from Aglinby with perfect grades, or if he'd found Glendower, or if he was still alive. And Ronan didn't have to worry about any of that. 2 years earlier, Adam had made his decision to come to Aglinby, and in his head, it was sort of because of Ronan. His mother had sent him to the grocery store with her bank card. All that had been on the conveyor belt was a tube of toothpaste and 4 cans of microwave ravioli, and the cashier had just told him there were insufficient funds in her bank account to cover the purchase. Though it was not his failing, there was something peculiarly humiliating and intimate about the moment, hunched at the head of a shopping line, turning out his pockets to pretend he might have the cash to cover instead. While he fumbled there, a shaved-headed boy at the next register moved swiftly through, swiping a credit card and collecting his things in only a few seconds. Even the way the other boy had moved, Adam recalled, had struck him. Confident and careless, shoulders rolled back, chin tilted, an emperor's son. As the cashier swiped Adam's card again, both of them pretending the machine might have misread the magnetic stripe, Adam watched the other boy go out to the curb to where a shiny black car waited. When the boy opened the door, Adam saw the other two boys inside wore raven-breasted sweaters and ties. They were despicably carefree as they divvied up the drinks. He'd had to leave the boxes and the toothpaste on the conveyor belt, eyes hot with shamed tears that wouldn't fall. He'd never wanted to be someone else so badly. In his head, that boy was Ronan, but in retrospect, Adam thought it couldn't have been. He wouldn't have been old enough to have his driver's license yet. It was just some other Aglinby student with a working credit card and exquisite car. And also, that day wasn't the only reason he'd decided to fight to come to Aglinby, but it was the catalyst. The imagined memory of Ronan, careless and shallow, but with pride fully intact, and Adam, cowed and humiliated while a line of old ladies waited behind him. He still wasn't that other boy at the register, but he was closer. Adam looked at his battered old watch to see how late Gansey was. He told Ronan, "Give me your phone." With a raised eyebrow, Ronan retrieved the phone from the roof of the BMW. Adam punched in the psychic's number. It rang just twice, and then a breathy voice said, "Adam?" Startled at the sound of his name, Adam replied, "Blue?"
"No," the voice said. "Persephone."
Then to someone in the background,
$10, Orla. That was the bet. No, the caller ID doesn't say anything at all, see?"
Then back to Adam.
"Sorry about that. I'm terrible when there's competition involved. You're the Coca-Cola t-shirt one, right?"
It took Adam a moment to realize that she meant the shirt he'd worn to the reading.
Oh, yeah.
"How wonderful. I'll go get Blue."
There was a brief, uncomfortable moment while voices murmured in the background of the telephone. Adam swatted at gnats. The parking lot needed to be mowed again. The asphalt was hard to see in some places.
"I didn't think you'd call," Blue said.
Adam must not have truly expected to get Blue on the phone because the surprise he felt when he heard her voice made his stomach feel hollowed out. Ronan was smirking in a way that made him want to punch his arm.
"I said I would. Thanks for the flowers. They were pretty."
Then she hissed, "Orla, get out of here!" It seems busy there. It's always busy here. There are 342 people who live here, and they all want to be in this room. What are you doing today?
She asked it very naturally, like it was the most logical thing in the world for them to have a conversation on the phone, like they were already friends. It made it easier for Adam to say,
"Exploring? Do you want to come with?"
Ronan's eyes widened. No matter what she said now, the phone call had been worth it for the genuine shock on Ronan's face.
What sort of exploring?
Shielding his eyes, Adam lifted his eyes to the sky. He thought he could hear Gansey coming.
Mountains? How do you feel about helicopters?
There was a long pause.
How do you mean? Ethically?
As a mode of transportation?
Faster than camels, but less sustainable. Is there going to be a helicopter in your future today?
Yeah. Gansey wants to look for the ley line, and they're usually easier to spot from the air.
And of course he just got a helicopter.
He's Gansey.
There was another long pause. It was a thinking pause, Adam thought, so he didn't interrupt it. Finally, Blue said,
"Okay, I'll come. Is this a... what is this?"
Adam replied truthfully,
"I have no idea."
21.
It was remarkably easy to disobey Maura.
Maura Sargent had very little experience disciplining children, and Blue had very little experience being disciplined, so there was nothing to stop Blue from going with Adam when he met her in front of the house. She didn't even feel guilty yet, because she had no practice in that either. Really, the most remarkable thing about the entire situation was how hopeful she felt, against all odds. She was going against her mother's wishes, meeting with a boy, meeting with a raven boy. She should have been dreading it. But it was very difficult to imagine Adam as a raven boy as he greeted her, his hands neatly in his pockets, scented with the dusty odor of mown grass. His bruise was older and therefore more dreadful looking.
"You look nice," he said, walking with her down the sidewalk.
She was uncertain if he was being serious. She wore heavy boots she'd found at the Goodwill. She'd attacked them with embroidery thread and a very sturdy needle, and a dress she'd made a few months earlier constructed from several different layers of green fabric. Some of them striped, some of them crochet, some of them transparent. It made Adam look quite conservative, like she was abducting him. They did not, Blue mused with a bit of unease, look anything like a couple.
"Thanks," she replied, then fast before she could lose her nerve, "Why did you want my number?"
Adam kept walking, but he didn't look away. He seemed shy until he didn't.
"Why wouldn't I?"
"Don't take this the wrong way," Blue replied. Her cheeks felt a little warm, but she was well into this conversation and she couldn't back down now.
"Because I know you're going to think I feel bad about it, and I don't."
"All right."
"Because I'm not pretty. Not in the way that Aglinby boys seem to like."
"I go to Aglinby," Adam said.
Adam did not seem to go to Aglinby like other boys went to Aglinby.
"I think you're pretty," he said.
When he said it, she heard his Henrietta accent for the first time that day, a long vowel and pretty like it rhymed with biddy. In a nearby tree, a cardinal went weak, weak, weak.
Adam's sneakers scuffed on the sidewalk. Blue considered what he had said, and then she considered it some more.
"Pshaw," she said finally. She felt like when she'd first read his card with the flowers, weirdly undone. It was like his words had spun tight some sort of thread between them, and she felt like she ought to somehow ease the tension.
"But thanks. I think you're pretty, too."
He laughed his surprised laugh.
"I have another question," Blue said. "Do you remember the last thing my mother said to Gansey?"
His rueful face made it clear that he did.
"Right," Blue took a deep breath. "She said she wouldn't help, but I didn't."
After he'd called, she'd hastily scrawled an unspecific map to the unnamed church where she'd sat with Neve on St. Mark's Eve. It was just a few scratched parallel lines to indicate the main road, some spidery named cross streets, and finally a square labeled only
the church. She handed Adam this map, unimpressive on a wrinkled piece of notebook paper. Then from her bag, she handed him Gansey's journal. Adam stopped walking. Blue, a few feet ahead of him, waited as he frowned at the things in his hands. He held the journal very carefully, like it was important to him, or perhaps like it was important to someone who was important to him. Desperately, she wanted him to both trust her and respect her, and she could tell from his face that she didn't have much time to accomplish either. "Gansey left that at Nino's," she said quickly. "The book. I know I should have given it back at the reading, but my mom, well, you saw her. She isn't normally like that. I didn't know what to think. Here's the thing. I want to be in on this thing that you guys are doing. Like, if there really is something supernatural going on, I want to see it. That's all." Adam merely asked, "Why?" With him, there was never any option but the truth said as simply as possible. She didn't think he would stand for anything else. "I'm the only person in my family who's not psychic. You heard my mom. I just make things easier for people who are psychic. If magic exists, I just want to see it. Just once."
"You're as bad as Gansey," Adam said, but he didn't sound as if he thought that was very bad at all. "He doesn't need anything but to know it's real."
He tilted the notebook paper this way and that. Blue was instantly relieved. She hadn't realized how still he'd been until he'd begun to move again, and now it was like tension had been bled out of the air. "That's the way to the corpse ro-" "The ley line," she explained, pointing at her scratchy map. "The church is on the ley line."
"You're sure?"
Blue gave him a deeply withering look.
"Look, either you're going to believe me or not. You're the one who asked me along exploring."
Adam's face melted into a grin, an expression so unlike his usual one that his features needed to completely shift to accommodate it.
"So you don't do anything quiet, do you?"
The way he said it, she could tell that he was impressed with her in the way that men were usually impressed with Orla. Blue very much liked that, especially since she hadn't had to do anything other than be herself to earn it. "Nothing worth doing."
"Well," he said, "I think you'll find I do pretty much everything quiet. If you can be all right with that, I guess we'll be fine."
It turned out that she had walked or biked past Gansey's apartment every single day of the year, on the way to school and to Nino's. As they walked toward the massive warehouse, she spotted the fiendishly orange glint of the Camaro in the overgrown parking lot, and only 100 yards away, a glistening navy blue helicopter. She hadn't really believed the part about the helicopter. Not in a way that prepared her for seeing an actual life-sized helicopter sitting there in the lot looking normal, like someone would park an SUV. Blue stopped in her tracks and breathed.
"Phew."
"I know," Adam said. And here again was Gansey. And again, Blue had a strange shock of reconciling the image of him as a spirit and the reality of him beside a helicopter.
"Finally," he shouted, jogging out toward them.
He was still wearing those idiotic topsiders she'd noticed at the reading, this time paired with cargo shorts and a yellow polo shirt that made it look as if he were prepared for any sort of emergency, so long as the emergency involved him falling onto a yacht. In his hand, he held a container of organic apple juice. He pointed his no-pesticides juice at Blue.
"Are you coming with?"
Just as at the reading, Blue felt cheap and small and stupid just by being in his presence. Clipping her Henrietta vowels as best as she could, she answered,
"Coming along in the helicopter you just happen to have at your beck and call, you mean?"
Gansey slung a burnished leather backpack over his burnished cotton shoulders. His smile was gracious and inclusive, as if her mother hadn't recently refused to assist him in any way, as if she hadn't just been borderline rude.
"You say that like it's a bad thing."
Behind him, the helicopter began to roar to life. Adam stretched out the journal to Gansey, who looked startled. Just a tiny bit of his composure slid, enough for Blue to see once more that it was part of his president's cell phone mask.
"Where was it?" yelled Gansey.
And he had to yell. Now that it was running, the blades of the helicopter didn't so much roar as scream. Air beat against Blue's ears, more feeling than sound. Adam pointed at Blue. "Thanks," Gansey shouted back. It was a default answer, she saw. He fell back onto his powerful politeness when he was taken by surprise. Also, he was still watching Adam, taking his cues from him as to how he should react to her. Adam nodded once, briefly, and the mask slipped just a little more. Blue wondered if the president's cell phone demeanor ever vanished completely when he was around his friends. Maybe the Gansey she'd seen in the churchyard was what lay beneath. That was a sobering thought. The air rumbled around them. Blue felt like her dress would fly away. She asked, "Is this thing safe?" "Safe as life," Gansey replied. "Adam, we're behind schedule. Blue, if you're coming, tighten your Liberty bodice and come on." As he ducked to approach the helicopter, his shirt, too, flapped against his back. Blue was suddenly a little nervous. It wasn't that she was scared, exactly. It was just that she hadn't psychologically prepared herself for leaving the ground with a bunch of Raven boys when she'd woken up this morning. The helicopter, for all its size and noise, seemed like a pretty insubstantial thing to trust her life to, and the boys felt like strangers. Now it felt like she was truly disobeying Mora. "I've never flown," she confessed to Adam, a shout to be heard over the whine of the helicopter. "Ever?" Adam shouted back. She shook her head. He put his mouth right against her ear so that she could hear him. He smelled like summer and cheap shampoo. She felt a tickle go all the way from her belly button to her feet. "I've flown once," he replied. His breath was hot on her skin. Blue was paralyzed. All she could think was, this is how close a kiss is. It felt every bit as dangerous as she'd imagined. He added, "I hated it." A moment passed, both of them motionless. She needed to tell him that he couldn't kiss her, just in case he was her true love. But how could she? How could she tell a boy that before she even knew if he wanted to kiss her at all? She felt him take her hand. His palm was sweaty. He really did hate flying. At the door to the helicopter, Gansey looked back over his shoulder at them, his smile complicated when he saw them holding hands. "I hate this," Adam shouted at Gansey. His cheeks were red. "I know," Gansey yelled back. Inside the helicopter, there was room for three passengers on a bench seat in the back, and one in a utilitarian seat beside the pilot. The interior would have resembled the back seat of a really big car if the seat belts hadn't had 5-point fasteners that looked like they belonged in an X-wing fighter. Blue didn't like to think why passengers had to be strapped down so securely. Possibly they were expecting people to be bounced against the walls. Ronan, the Raven boy, who was more Raven boy than the others, was already installed in a window seat. He didn't smile when he looked up. Adam, punching Ronan's arm, took the middle seat, while Blue took the remaining window seat. As she toyed with the seatbelt straps, Gansey leaned into the cabin to knock knuckles with Adam. A few minutes later, when Gansey climbed into the front seat beside the pilot, she saw that he was grinning, effusive and earnest, incredibly excited to be going wherever they were going. It was nothing like his previous polished demeanor. It was some private joy that she managed to be in on by virtue of being in the helicopter, and just like that, Blue was excited, too. Adam leaned toward her as if he was about to say something, but ultimately he just shook his head, smiling, like Gansey was a joke that was too complicated to explain. In front, Gansey turned to the pilot, who surprised Blue a little, a young woman with an impressively straight nose, her brown hair swept into a beautiful knot, headphones clamping down any loose strands. She seemed to find Blue and Adam's proximity far more interesting than Gansey had. The pilot shouted at Gansey, "Aren't you going to introduce us, Dick?" Gansey made a face. "Blue," he said, "I'd like you to meet my sister, Helen." 22. There wasn't much Gansey didn't like about flying. He liked airports, with their masses of people all doing things, and he liked planes, with their thick-paned windows and fold-out trays. The way that a jet charged down a runway reminded him of how the Camaro pressed him back in the driver's seat when he hit the gas. The whine of a helicopter sounded like productivity. He liked the little knobs and toggles and gauges of cockpits, and he liked the technological backwardness of the simple clasp seatbelts. Gansey derived a large part of his pleasure from meeting goals, and a large part of that large part was pleased by meeting goals efficiently. There was nothing more efficient than aiming for your destination as the crow flew. And of course, from 1,000 feet, Henrietta took Gansey's breath away. Below them, the surface of the world was deeply green, and cutting through the green was a narrow, shining river, a mirror to the sky. He could follow it with his eyes all the way to the mountains. Now that they were in the air, Gansey was feeling a little anxious. With Blue here, he was beginning to feel as if possibly he'd overdone it with the helicopter. He wondered if it would make Blue feel better or worse to know that it was Helen's helicopter, that he hadn't paid anything today for the use of it. Probably worse. Remembering his vow to at least do no harm with his words, he kept his mouth shut. "There she is," Helen's voice reported directly into Gansey's ears. In the helicopter, they all wore headsets to allow them to converse through the ceaseless noise of the blades and the engine. "Gansey's girlfriend." Ronan's snort barely made it through his headset, but Gansey had heard it often enough to know it was there. Blue said, "She must be pretty big to see her from up here." "Henrietta," Helen replied. She peered to the left of the helo as she banked. "They're getting married. They haven't set a date yet." "If you're going to embarrass me, I'll throw you out and fly myself," Gansey said from the seat beside her. This was not a true threat. Not only would he not push Helen out at this altitude, he wasn't legal to fly without her. Also, truth be told, he wasn't very good at flying a helicopter, despite several lessons. He seemed to lack the important ability to orient himself vertically as well as horizontally, which led to disagreements involving trees. He comforted himself with the knowledge that at least he could parallel park very well. "Did you get Mom a birthday present?" Helen asked. "Yes," Gansey replied. "Myself," Helen said, "the gift that keeps on giving." He said, "I don't think that minor children are required to get gifts for their parents. I'm a dependent. That's the definition of dependent, is it not?" "You a dependent," his sister said and laughed. Helen had a laugh like a cartoon character. "Ha ha ha ha." It was an intimidating laugh that tended to make men suspect that they were possibly the brunt of it. "You haven't been a dependent since you were 4. You went straight from kindergarten to old man with a studio apartment." Gansey made a dismissive hand gesture. His sister was known for hyperbole. "What did you get her?" "It's a surprise," Helen replied loftily, tapping some sort of toggle switch with a pink-nailed finger. The pink was the only fanciful thing about her. Helen was beautiful in the way a supercomputer was beautiful, sleek, with elegant but utilitarian styling, full of top-notch technological know-how, far too expensive for most people to possess. "That means it's glassware." Gansey's mother collected rare painted plates with the same obsessive fervor that Gansey collected facts about Glendower. He had a hard time seeing the allure of a plate robbed of its original purpose, but his mother's collection had been featured in magazines and was insured for more than his father, so clearly she was not alone in her passion. Helen was stony. "I don't want to hear it. You didn't get her anything." "I didn't say anything about it." "You called it glassware." He asked, "What should I have said?" "They're not all glass. This one I found her is not glass." "Then she won't like it." Helen's face shifted from stony to very stony. She glowered at her GPS. Gansey didn't like to think of how much time she'd invested in her non-glass plate. He didn't like to see either of the women in his family disappointed. It ruined perfectly good meals. Helen was still silent. So Gansey began to think about Blue. Something about her was discomforting him, though he couldn't put his finger on it. Taking a mint leaf from his pocket, Gansey put it into his mouth and watched the familiar Henrietta Road snake below them. From the air, the curves looked less perilous than they felt in the Camaro. What was it about Blue? Adam was not suspicious of her, and he was suspicious of everyone. But then again, he was clearly infatuated. That, too, was unfamiliar ground for Gansey. "Adam," he said. There was no answer, and Gansey looked over his shoulder. Adam's headphones were looped around his neck, and he was leaned over beside Blue, pointing something out on the ground below. As she'd shifted, Blue's dress had gotten hitched up, and Gansey could see a long, slender triangle of her thigh. Adam's hand was braced a few inches away on the seat, knuckles pale with his hatred of flying. There was nothing particularly intimate about the way they sat, but something about the scene made Gansey feel strange, like he'd heard an unpleasant statement and later forgotten everything about the words but the way they had made him feel.
"Adam!" Gansey shouted, his friend's head jerked up, face startled. He hurried to pull his headset back on. His voice came through the headphones. "Are you done talking about your mom's plate?"
"Very. Where should we go this time? I was thinking maybe back to the church where I recorded the voice."
Adam handed Gansey a wrinkled piece of paper. Gansey flattened the paper and found a crude map.
"What's this?"
"Blue." Gansey looked at her intently, trying to decide if she had anything to gain by misdirecting them. She didn't flinch from his gaze. Turning back around, he spread the paper flat on the controls in front of him.
"Make that happen, Helen."
Helen banked to follow the new direction. The church Blue directed them toward was probably 40 minutes' drive from Henrietta, but as the bird flew, it was only 15. Without a quiet noise from Blue, Gansey would have missed it. It was a ruin, hollowed and overgrown. A narrow line of an old, old stone wall was visible around it, as well as an impression on the ground where an additional wall must have originally been.
"That's it?"
"That's all there is left." Something inside Gansey went very still and quiet. He said,
"What did you say?"
"It's a ruin, but..."
"No," he said. "Say precisely what you said before, please."
Blue cast a glance toward Adam, who shrugged.
"I don't remember what I said. Was it, that's all there is?"
"That's all. Is that all?" That was what had been nagging him all this time. He knew he recognized her voice. He knew that Henrietta accent. He knew that cadence. It was Blue's voice on the recorder. "Gansey, is that all? That's all there is."
"I'm not made out of fuel," Helen snapped, as if she'd already said it once and Gansey had missed it. Maybe he had. "Tell me where to go from here."
What does this mean? Once more he began to feel the press of responsibility, awe, something bigger than him. At once he was anticipatory and afraid.
"What's the lay of the line, Blue?"
Adam asked. Blue, who had her thumb and forefinger pressed against the glass as if she was measuring something, answered,
"There. Toward the mountains. Fly. Do you see those two oak trees? The church is one point, and another point is right between them. If we make a straight line between those two, that's the path."
If it had been Blue he'd been talking to on St. Mark's Eve, what did that mean?
"Are you certain?" This was Helen in her brisk supercomputer voice. "I only have an hour and a half of fuel."
Blue sounded a little indignant.
"I wouldn't have said it if I wasn't sure."
Helen smiled faintly and pushed the helicopter in the direction Blue had indicated.
"Blue."
It was Ronan's voice for the first time, and everyone, even Helen, twisted their heads toward him. His head was cocked in a way that Gansey recognized as dangerous. Something in his eyes was sharp as he stared at Blue. He asked, "Do you know Gansey?"
Gansey remembered Ronan leaning against the pig playing the recording over and over again.
Blue looked defensive under their stares. She said reluctantly, "Only his name." With his fingers linked loosely together, elbows on his knees, Ronan leaned forward across Adam to be closer to Blue. He could be unbelievably threatening.
"And how is it," he asked, "you came to know Gansey's name?"
To her credit, Blue didn't back down. Her ears were pink, but she said, "First of all, get out of my face."
"What if I don't?"
"Ronan," said Gansey.
Ronan sat back.
"I would like to know, though," Gansey said. His heart felt like it weighed nothing at all. Looking down, Blue bunched a few of the layers of her improbable dress in her hands. Finally, she said, "I guess that's fair." She pointed at Ronan. She looked angry.
"But that is not the way to get me to answer anything. Next time he gets in my face, I'll let you find this thing on your own. I'll... Look,
I'll tell you how I knew your name if you explain to me what that shape is that you have in your journal.
Tell me why we're negotiating with terrorists, Ronan asked.
Since when am I a terrorist? Demanded Blue. Seems to me I came bringing something you guys wanted, and you're being dicks.
Not all of us, Adam said.
I'm not being a dick, Gansey said. He was uncomfortable with the idea that she might not like him.
Now what is this thing you want to know?
Blue reached her hand out.
Hold on, I'll show you what I mean.
Gansey let her take the journal again. Leafing through the pages, she turned it to him so that she could see the one in question. The page detailed an artifact he'd found in Pennsylvania. He'd also doodled on it in several places.
I believe that is a man chasing a car, Gansey said.
Not that. This.
She pointed to one of the other doodles.
They're ley lines.
He stretched out a hand for the journal. For a strange, hyper-aware moment, he realized how closely she watched him as he took it. He didn't think it missed her notice how his left hand curved familiarly around the leather binding, how the thumb and finger on his right hand knew just how much pressure to apply to coax the pages to spread where he wanted them to. The journal and Gansey were clearly long acquainted, and he wanted her to know.
This is me, the real me.
He didn't want to analyze the source of this impulse too hard. He focused on flipping through the journal instead. It took him no time at all to find the desired page, a map of the United States marked all over with curving lines. He traced a finger over one line that stretched through New York City and Washington, D.C., another intersecting line that stretched from Boston to St. Louis, a third that cut horizontally across the first two, stretching through Virginia and Kentucky and on west. There was, as always, something satisfying about tracing the lines, something that called to mind scavenger hunts and childhood drawings. These are the three main lines, Gansey said, the ones that seem to matter.
Seem to matter how?
How much of this did you read?
Some. A lot. Most.
He continued. The ones that seem to matter as far as finding Glendower. That line across Virginia is the one that connects us to the UK, the United Kingdom.
She rolled her eyes dramatically enough that he caught the gesture without turning his head.
I know what the UK is, thanks. The public school system isn't that bad.
He'd managed to offend again, with no effort at all. He concurred.
Surely not.
Those other two lines have a lot of reports of unusual sightings on them, of paranormal stuff. Poltergeists, and mothmen, and black dogs.
But his hesitation was unnecessary. Blue didn't scoff.
My mother drew that shape, she said. The ley lines. So did Neat, one of the other women here. They didn't know what it was, though, only that it would be significant. That's why I wanted to know.
Now you, Ronan said to Blue.
I saw Gansey's spirit, she said. I've never seen one before. I don't see things like that, but this time I did. I asked you your name, and you told me Gansey. That's all there is. Honestly, it's part of the reason why I wanted to come along today.
This answer satisfied Gansey fairly well. She was, after all, the daughter of a psychic, and it matched the account his recorder gave, though it struck him as a partial answer.
Ronan demanded, "Saw him where?"
While I was sitting outside with one of my half-aunts.
This seemed to satisfy Ronan as well, because he asked, "What's the other half of her?"
"God, Ronan," Adam said, "enough." There was a moment of tense silence, occupied only by the continuous droning whine of the helicopter. They were waiting, Gansey knew, for his verdict. Did he believe her answer? Did he think they should follow her directions? Did he trust her?
Her voice was on the recorder. He felt like he didn't have a choice. What he was thinking, but didn't want to say with Helen listening in, was,
"You're right, Ronan. It's starting. Something's starting." He was also thinking, "Tell me what you think of her, Adam. Tell me why you trust her. Don't make me decide for once. I don't know if I'm right."
But what he said was, "I'm going to need everyone to be straight with each other from now on. No more games. This isn't just for Blue, either. All of us."
Ronan said, "I'm always straight."
Adam replied. Oh, man, that's the biggest lie you've ever told.
Blue said, okay.
Gansey suspected that none of them was being completely honest with their replies, but at least he'd told them what he wanted. Sometimes, all he could hope for was getting it on the record. The headsets fell silent as Adam, Blue, and Gansey all stared intently out the window. Below them was green and more green, everything toy-like and quaint from this height, a place set of velvet fields and broccoli trees.
What are we looking for? Helen asked.
Gansey said, the usual.
What's the usual? Blue asked.
The usual, more often than not, turned out to be acres of nothing, but Gansey said, sometimes the ley lines are marked in ways that are visible from the air. Like in the UK, some of the lines are marked with horses carved into hillsides.
He'd been in a small fixed-wing plane with Mallory the first time that he'd seen the Uffington horse, a 300-foot horse scraped into the side of an English chalk hill. Like everything associated with the ley lines, the horse was not quite ordinary. The horse was stretched and stylized, an elegant, eerie silhouette that was more suggestion of a horse than actual horse.
Tell her about Nazca, murmured Adam.
Oh, right, Gansey said. Even though Blue had read much of the journal, there was a lot that wasn't in it, and unlike Ronan and Adam and Noah, she hadn't lived this life for the past year. It was suddenly difficult not to be excited by the idea of explaining it all to her. The story always sounded more plausible when he laid all of the facts out at once. He continued, in Peru, there are hundreds of lines cut into the ground in the shapes of things like birds and monkeys and men and imaginary creatures. Thousands of years old, but they only make sense from the air, from an airplane. They're too big to see from the ground. When you're standing next to them, they just look like scraped footpaths.
You've seen them in person, Blue said.
When Gansey had seen the Nazca lines for himself, massive and strange and symmetrical, he'd known that he wouldn't be able to give up until he found Glendower. The scale of the lines was what had struck him first. Hundreds upon hundreds of feet of curious drawings in the middle of the desert. He'd been stunned by the precision. The drawings were mathematical in their perfection, faultless in their symmetry. And the last thing to hit him, right in his gut, was the emotional impact, a mysterious raw ache that wouldn't go away. Gansey felt like he couldn't survive not knowing if the lines meant something. That was the only part of his hunt for Glendower that he could never seem to explain to people.
Gansey, Adam said, what's that there?
The helicopter slowed as all four passengers craned their necks. By now, they were deep into the mountains, and the ground had risen to meet them. All around them were rippling flanks of mysterious green forests, a rolling dark sea from above. Among the slopes and gullies, however, was a slanting, green-carpeted field marked by a pale fracture of lines.
Does it make a shape? He asked. Helen, stop! Stop!
Do you think this is a bicycle? Demanded Helen, but the helicopter's forward progress stopped.
Look, Adam said. There's a wing there, and there, a beak. A bird?
No, Ronan said, voice cold and even. Not just a bird. It's a raven.
Slowly the form became clear to Gansey, emerging from the overgrown grass. A bird, yes. Neck twisted backward and wings pressed as if in a book. Tail feathers splayed and claws simplified. Ronan was right. Even stylized, the dome of the head, the generous curve of the beak, and the ruffle of feathers on its neck made the bird unmistakably a raven. His skin prickled.
Put the helicopter down, Gansey said immediately.
Helen replied, I can't land on private property.
He cast an entreating gaze at his sister. He needed to write down the GPS coordinates. He needed to take a photo for his records. He needed to sketch the shape of it in his journal. More than anything, he needed to touch the lines of the bird and make it real in his head.
Helen, 2 seconds.
Her return look was knowing. It was the sort of condescending look that might have caused arguments when he was younger and more easily riled.
If the landowner discovers me there and decides to press charges, I could lose my license.
2 seconds. You saw? There's no one around here for miles and miles. No houses.
Helen's gaze was very level. I'm supposed to be at Mom and Dad's in 2 hours.
2 seconds.
Finally, she rolled her eyes and sat back in her seat. Shaking her head, she turned back toward the controls. Thank you, Helen, Adam said.
2 seconds, she repeated grimly. If you aren't done by then, I'm taking off without you.
The helicopter landed 15 feet away from the strange raven's heart.
23. As soon as the helicopter had touched down, Gansey leapt from the cabin and strode into the thigh-high grass as if he owned the place, Ronan by his side. Through the open door of the helo, Blue heard him say Noah's name to the phone before repeating the GPS coordinates for the field. He was energized and powerful, a king in his castle. Blue, on the other hand, was a little slower. For a multitude of reasons, her legs felt a little gelled after flying. She wasn't sure if not telling Gansey the entire truth about St. Mark's Eve was the right decision, and she was worried about Ronan trying to speak to her again. It smelled wonderful in the middle of this field, though. All grass and trees and somewhere water, and lots of it. Blue thought she might live here quite happily. Beside her, Adam shielded his eyes. He looked at home here, his hair the same colorless brown as the tips of old grass, and he looked more handsome than Blue remembered. She thought about how Adam had taken her hand earlier and considered how much she'd like for him to do it again. With some surprise, Adam said, "Those lines are pretty invisible from here." He was right, of course. Though Blue had just seen the raven as they touched down beside it, whatever geographical feature had made the shape was now completely hidden. "I still hate flying. Sorry about Ronan." "The flying part wasn't bad," Blue said. Actually, aside from Ronan, she had kind of liked it. The sense of floating in a very noisy bubble where all directions were possible. "I thought it would be worse. You sort of have to give up control, don't you? And then it's okay. Now Ronan, he's a pit bull," Adam said. "I know some really nice pit bulls." One of the dogs Blue walked each week was a cow-printed pit bull with as nice a smile as you could hope for in a canine.
"He's the kind of pit that makes the evening news. Gansey's trying to retrain him."
"How noble. It makes him feel better about being Gansey." Blue didn't doubt it. "Sometimes he's very condescending." Adam looked at the ground. "He doesn't mean to be. It's all that blue blood in his veins." He was about to say something else when a shout interrupted him.
"Are you listening, Glendower? I am coming to find you."
Gansey's voice, ebullient and ringing, echoed off the tree-covered slopes around the field. Adam and Blue found him standing in the middle of a clear, pale path, his arms stretched out and his head tilted back as he shouted into the air. Adam's mouth made the soundless shape of a laugh. Gansey grinned at them both. He was hard to resist in this form, glowing with rows and rows of white teeth, a college brochure in the making. "Oyster shells," he said, leaning to pick up one of the pale objects that made up the path. The fragment was pure white, the edges blunt and worn. "That's what makes up the raven, like they use for roads down in the tidewater area. Oyster shells on bare rock. What do you think of that?"
"I think that's a lot of oyster shells to bring from the coast," Adam replied. "I also think Glendower would have come from the coast, too."
Gansey pointed at Adam by way of a reply. Blue put her hands on her hips.
"So you think they put Glendower's body on a boat in Wales, sailed over to Virginia, then brought him up to the mountains? Why?"
"Energy," Gansey replied. Rummaging in his bag, he removed a small black box that looked a lot like a very small car battery. Blue asked, "What's that? It looks expensive." He twiddled with switches on the side as he explained, "An electromagnetic frequency meter. It monitors energy levels. Some people use them for ghost hunting. It's supposed to have a high reading when you're near a spirit."
but it's also supposed to read high when you're near an energy source, like a ley line. She scowled at the gadget. A box to register magic seemed to insult both the box holder and magic. And of course, you have an electromagnetic button thing. Everyone has one of them. Gansey held the meter above his head as if he were calling aliens. You find it not normal? She could tell that he very much wanted her to say that he wasn't normal, so she replied, Oh, I'm sure it's quite normal in some circles. He looked a little hurt, but most of his attention was on the meter, which showed two faint red lights. He remarked, I'd like to be in those circles. So, like I said, energy. One of the other names for the ley line is corpse. Corpse Road, Blue interrupted. I know. He looked pleased and magnanimous, as if she were a prize pupil. So school me. You probably know better than I. As before, his accent was the broad, glorious old Virginia accent, and Blue's words felt clumsy beside him. I just know that the dead travel in straight lines, she said, that they used to carry corpses in straight lines to churches to bury them, along what you call the ley line. It was supposed to be really bad to take them any other route than the way they'd choose to travel as a spirit. Right, he said. So it stands to reason there's something about the line that fortifies or protects a corpse. The soul, the animus, the quiddity of it. Gansey, seriously, Adam interrupted to Blue's relief. Nobody knows what quiddity is. The whatness, Adam. Whatever it is that makes a person what they are. If they removed Glendower from the corpse road, I think the magic that keeps him asleep would be disrupted. She said, Basically, you mean he would die for good if he was removed from the line? Yes, Gansey said. The blinking lights on his machine had begun to flash more heavily, leading them over the raven's beak and toward the tree line where Ronan already stood. Blue lifted her arms up so the heads of the grass wouldn't hit the backs of her hands. It was up to her waist in some places. She asked, And why not just leave him in Wales? Isn't that where they want him to wake up and be a hero? It was an uprising, and he was a traitor to the English crown, Gansey said. The easy way that he began the story, at once striding through grass and eyeing the EMF reader, let Blue know that he had told it many times before. Glendower fought the English for years, and it was ugly, all struggle between noble families with mixed allegiances. The Welsh resistance failed. Glendower disappeared. If the English had known where he was, dead or alive, there's no way they'd treat his body the way the Welsh wanted it treated. Haven't you heard of being hung, drawn, and quartered? Blue asked, Is it as painful as conversations with Ronan? Gansey cast a glance over to Ronan, who was a small, indistinct form by the trees. Adam audibly swallowed a laugh. Depends on if Ronan is sober, Gansey answered. Adam asked, What is he doing, anyway? Peeing. Trust Lynch to deface a place like this 5 minutes after getting here. Deface? Marking his territory. He must own more of Virginia than your father, then. I don't think he's ever used an indoor toilet, now that I consider it. This all seemed very manly and Aglinby to Blue, this calling of one another by last names and bantering about outdoor urinary habits. It also seemed like it could go on for a long time, so she interrupted, changing the subject back to Glendower. They'd really go to all this trouble to hide his body? Gansey said, Well, Ned Kelly... He delivered the nonsensical statement so matter-of-factly that Blue felt abruptly stupid, as if maybe the public school system really was lacking. Then Adam said, with a glance toward Blue, Nobody knows who Ned Kelly is either, Gansey. Really? Gansey asked, so innocently startled by this that it was clear that Adam had been right before. He hadn't meant to be condescending. He was an Australian outlaw. When the British caught him, they did awful things with his body. I think the chief of police used his head as a paperweight for a while. Just think what Glendower's enemies would do to him. If the Welsh wanted a shot at Glendower being resurrected, they would have wanted his body unmolested. Why the mountains, then? Blue insisted. Why isn't he right on the shore? This seemed to remind Gansey of something, because instead of replying to her, He turned to Adam. I called Mallory about that ritual to see if he'd tried it. He said he didn't think it could be performed just anywhere on the ley line. He guessed it had to be done on the heart of it, where the most energy is. I'm thinking that someplace like that is also where they'd want Glendower. Adam turned to Blue. What about your energy? The question took her by surprise. What? You said that you made things louder for other psychics, Adam said. Is that about energy? Blue was absurdly pleased that he remembered, and also absurdly pleased that he'd replied to her instead of Gansey, who was now swatting gnats out of his eyes and waiting for her response. Yes, she said. I guess I make things that need energy stronger. I'm like a walking battery. You're the table everyone wants at Starbucks, Gansey mused as he began to walk again. Blue blinked. What? Over his shoulder, Gansey said, next to the wall plug. He pressed the EMF reader into the side of a tree and observed both objects with great interest. Adam shook his head at Blue. To Gansey, he said, I'm saying that she could maybe turn a regular part of the ley line into a doable place for the ritual. Wait, are we going in the woods? What about Helen? It hasn't been 2 seconds, Gansey said, although it clearly had been. That's an interesting idea about the energy. Though, can your battery get drained by things other than conversations about prostitution? She didn't dignify this comment with an immediate response. Instead, she thought about how her mother had said there was nothing to fear from the dead, and how Neve had seemed disbelieving. The church watch had obviously taken something from her. Maybe there were worse consequences that she had yet to discover. Well, this is interesting, Gansey remarked. He straddled a tiny stream at the very edge of the trees. It was really just water that had bubbled up from an underground source soaking the grass. Gansey's attention was focused entirely on the EMF reader he held directly above the water. The meter was pegged. Helen, Adam said warningly. Ronan had rejoined them, and both boys looked in the direction of the helicopter. I said, this is interesting, Gansey repeated. And I said, Helen, just a couple of yards. She'll be angry. Gansey's expression was baleful, and Blue could see immediately that Adam wouldn't hold out against it. I did tell you, Adam said. The stream trickled sluggishly out of the woods from between 2 diamond-barked dogwoods. With Gansey in the lead, they all followed the water into the trees. Immediately, the temperature dropped several degrees. Blue hadn't realized how much insect noise there was in the field until it was replaced by occasional bird song under the trees. This was a beautiful old wood, all massive oak and ash trees finding footing among great slabs of cracked stone. Ferns sprang from rocks, and verdant moss grew up the sides of the tree trunks. The air itself was scented with green and growing and water. The light was golden through the leaves. Everything was alive, alive. She breathed. This is lovely. It was for Adam, not Gansey, but she saw Gansey glance over his shoulder at her. Beside him, Ronan was curiously muted, something about his posture defensive. What are we even looking for? Adam asked. Gansey was a bloodhound, the EMF reader leading him along the widening stream. The moving water had become too wide to straddle, and now it ran in a bed of pebbles and sharp fragments of rock and, strangely enough, a few of the oyster shells. What we're always looking for, Adam warned. Helen is going to hate you. She'll text me if she gets too mad, Gansey said. To demonstrate, he slid his phone out of his pocket. Oh, there's no signal. Given their location in the mountains, the lack of signal was unsurprising, but Gansey stopped short. While the four of them made an uneven circle, he thumbed through the screens on his phone. In his other hand, the EMF reader glowed solid red. His voice sounded a little strange when he asked, "Is anyone else wearing a watch?" Weekends were not generally days of precise timing for Blue, so she was not, and Ronan had only his few knotted leather strands around his arm. Adam lifted his wrist. He wore a cheap-looking watch with a grubby band. I am,
he said, adding ruefully, but it doesn't seem to be working. Without speaking, Gansey turned the face of his phone to them. It was set to the clock function, and it took Blue a moment to realize that none of the hands were moving. For a long moment, the four of them just looked at the three still hands on the phone's clock face. Blue's heart marked off every second the clock didn't. "Is it?" Adam started and then stopped. He tried again. "Is it because the power is being affected from the energy of the line?" Ronan's voice was cutting. "Affecting your watch? Your wind-up watch?" "It's true," Gansey answered. "My phone's still on. So's the reader. It's only that the time has... I wonder if..." But there were no answers, and they all knew it. "I want to go on," Gansey said. "Just a little farther." He waited to see if they would stop him. No one said anything, but as Gansey set off again, clambering over the top of a slab of stone, Ronan beside him, Adam glanced at Blue. His expression asked, "Are you okay?" She was okay, but in the way she'd been okay before the helicopter. It was not that she was scared of flashing lights on the EMF reader or Adam's watch refusing to work, but she hadn't gotten out of bed in the morning expecting to encounter a place where possibly time didn't work. Blue stretched her hand out. Adam took it without hesitation, like he'd been waiting for her to offer it. He said in a low voice, just for her, "My heart is beating like crazy right now." Strangely enough, it was not his fingers twined in hers that affected Blue the strongest. It was where his warm wrist pressed against hers above their hands. "I need to tell him he can't kiss me," she thought. But not yet. Right now, she wanted to feel his skin pressed against hers, both of their pulses rapid and uncertain. Hand in hand, they climbed after Gansey. The trees grew even larger, some of them grown together into trunks like castles, turreted and huge. The canopy soared high overhead, rustling and reverent. Everything was green, green, green. Somewhere ahead, water splashed. For one brief moment, Blue thought she heard music. "Noah!" Gansey's voice sounded forlorn. He'd stopped by a mighty beech tree, and now he searched around himself. Catching up to him, Blue realized he'd stopped by the shore of a mountain pool that fed the stream they'd been following. The pool was only a few inches deep and perfectly clear. The water was so transparent that it begged to be touched. "I thought I heard..." Gansey broke off. His eyes dropped to where Adam held Blue's hand. Again, his face was somehow puzzled by the fact of their hand-holding. Adam's grip tightened, although she didn't think he meant for it to. This was a wordless discussion, too, though she didn't think either of the boys knew what they were trying to say. Gansey turned to the pool of water. In his hand, the EMF reader had gone dark. Crouching, he hovered his free hand over the water. His fingers were spread wide, millimeters from the surface. Beneath his hand, the water shifted and darkened, and Blue realized that there were 1,000 tiny fish just underneath. They flashed silver and then black as they moved, clinging to the faint shadow he cast. Adam asked, "How are there fish here?" The stream they'd followed into the woods was far too shallow for fish, and above them the pool seemed to be fed by rainfall from higher up the mountain. Fish didn't come from the sky. Gansey replied, "I don't know." The fish tumbled and coursed over one another, ceaselessly moving, tiny enigmas. Again, Blue thought she heard music, but when she looked at Adam, she thought perhaps it had just been the sound of his breathing. Gansey looked up to them, and she saw in his face that he loved this place. His bald expression held something new, not the raw delight of finding the ley line or the sly pleasure of teasing Blue. She recognized the strange happiness that came from loving something without knowing why you did. That strange happiness that was sometimes so big that it felt like sadness. It was the way she felt when she looked at the stars. Just like that, he was a little bit closer to the Gansey that Blue had seen in the churchyard, and she found she couldn't bear to look at him. Instead, she pulled her hand free from Adam to go to the beech tree Gansey stood beside.
Carefully, she stepped over the exposed knots of the beech's roots, and then she laid her palm on its smooth gray bark. Like the tree behind her house, this beech's bark was as cold as winter and oddly comforting.
Adam? This was Ronan's voice, and she heard Adam's footsteps moving cautiously and slowly around the edge of the pool toward it. The sound of snapping branches became softer as he moved farther away.
I don't think these fish are real, Gansey said softly.
It was such a ridiculous thing to say that Blue turned to look at him again. He was tipping his hand back and forth as he watched the water.
I think they're here because I thought they ought to be here, Gansey said.
Blue replied sarcastically, Okay, God.
He twisted his hand again. She saw the fish's forms flash in the water once more. Hesitant, he went on. At the reading, what was it that the one woman said with the hair?
She said it was about perception.
No, intention.
Persephone. Intention is for cards, Blue said. That's for a reading, for letting someone into your head, to see patterns in the future and the past, not for fish. How could intention work on a fish? Life isn't negotiable.
He asked, what color were the fish when we arrived?
They'd been black and silver, or at least they had looked it in the reflection.
Gansey, she was certain, was reaching for signs of inexplicable magic, but she wasn't going to be swayed so easily. Blue and brown could look black or silver, depending on the light. Nonetheless, she joined him, crouching in the moist dirt beside the pool. The fish were all dark and indistinct in the shadow of his hand.
I was watching them and wondering how they'd gotten here, and then I remembered that there was a kind of trout that often live in smaller creeks, Gansey said.
Wild brook trout, I think they're called.
I thought that would make a little more sense. Maybe they were introduced by man somehow in this pool or a pool farther up the stream. That's what I was thinking. Brook trout are silver on top and red on the bottom.
Okay, she said. Gansey's outstretched hand was very still.
Tell me there were no red fish in this pool when we arrived.
When she didn't answer, he looked at her. She shook her head. There'd definitely been no red.
He pulled his hand back quickly.
The tiny school of fish darted and leapt for cover, but not before Blue saw that every one of them was silver and red. Not a little red, but bright red, sunset red, red as a dream, like they had never been any other color.
I don't understand, Blue said. Something in her ached, though, like she did understand, but couldn't put words to it, wrap her thoughts around it. She felt like she was a part of a dream this place was having, or it was a part of a dream of hers.
I don't either.
They both turned their head at the same time then, at the sound of a voice from their left.
Was that Adam? Blue asked.
It seemed strange that she had to ask, but nothing felt very definite.
Again they heard Adam's voice, more clearly this time. He and Ronan stood on the other side of the pool. Just behind him was an oak tree. A man-sized rotten cavity gaped blackly in its trunk. In the pool at his feet was a reflection of both Adam and the tree, the mirror image colder and more distant than reality.
Adam rubbed his arms fiercely as if chilled. Ronan stood beside him, looking over his shoulder at something Blue couldn't see.
Come here, Adam said, and stand in there, and tell me if I'm losing my mind.
His accent was pronounced, which Blue was beginning to learn meant that he was too bothered to hide it.
Blue peered at the cavity. Like all holes in trees, it looked moist and uneven and black, the fungus and the bark still working away at enlarging the crater. The edges of the entrance were jagged and thin, making the tree's continued survival seem miraculous.
Are you okay? Gansey asked.
Close your eyes, Adam told him.
His arms were crossed, his hands gripping his biceps.
The way he was breathing reminded Blue of what it felt like to wake after a nightmare, heart pounding, breath snagging, legs aching from a chase you never really ran.
After you stand in there, I mean.
Did you go in there? Gansey asked Ronan, who shook his head.
He's the one who pointed it out, Adam said.
Ronan said, flat as a board, I'm not going in there. When he said it, it sounded like principle instead of cowardice, like his refusal to take a card at the reading.
I don't mind,
Blue said. I'll go. It was hard for her to imagine being intimidated when surrounded by a tree, no matter how strange the forest around it might be. Stepping into the cavity, she turned so that she faced the outside world. The air inside the cavity smelled damp and close. It was warm, too, and although Blue knew it must be because of the rotting process, it made the tree seem as warm-blooded as her. In front of her, Adam's arms were still gripped around himself. What does he think will happen in here? She closed her eyes. Almost at once, she could smell rain. Not the scent of rain coming, but the living, shifting odor of a storm currently waging. The wide-open scent of a breeze moving through water. Then she became aware that something was touching her face. When she opened her eyes, she was both in her body and watching it, nowhere near the cavity of the tree. The Blue that was before her stood inches away from a boy in an Aglimby sweater. There was a slight stoop to his posture, and his shoulders were spattered darkly with rain. It was his fingers that Blue felt on her face. He touched her cheeks with the backs of his fingers. Tears coursed down the other Blue's face. Through some strange magic, Blue could feel them on her face as well. She could feel, too, the sick, rising misery she'd felt in the churchyard, the grief that felt bigger than her. The other Blue's tears seemed endless. One drop slid after another, each following an identical path down her cheeks. The boy in the Aglimby sweater leaned his forehead against Blue's. She felt the pressure of his skin against hers, and suddenly she could smell mint. It'll be okay, Gansey told the other Blue. She could tell that he was afraid. It'll be okay. Impossibly, Blue realized that this other Blue was crying because she loved Gansey, and that the reason Gansey touched her like that, his fingers so careful with her, was because he knew that her kiss could kill him. She could feel how badly the other Blue wanted to kiss him, even as she dreaded it, though she couldn't understand why. Her real present-day memories in the tree cavity were clouded with other false memories of their lips nearly touching, a life this other Blue had already lived. Okay, I'm ready. Gansey's voice caught just a little. Blue, kiss me. Shaken, Blue opened her eyes for real, and now she saw the darkness of the cavity around her and smelled the dark, rotten scent of the tree again. Her guts were twisted with the ghostly grief and desire she'd felt in the vision. She was sick and embarrassed, and when she stepped out of the tree, she couldn't look at Gansey. Well, Gansey asked. She said, it's something. When she didn't elucidate further, he took her place in the tree. It had seemed so very real. Was this the future? Was this an alternate future? Was this just a waking dream? She couldn't imagine falling in love with Gansey of all people, but in that vision, it had seemed not just plausible, but indisputable. As Gansey turned inside the cavity, Adam took her arm and dragged her closer. He wasn't gentle, but Blue didn't think he meant to be rough. She did startle, though, when he wiped her face with the heel of his other hand. She had been crying real tears. I want you to know, Adam whispered furiously, I would never do that. It wasn't real. I'd never do that to him. His fingers were tight on her arm, and she felt him shaking. Blue blinked at Adam, wiping her cheeks dry. It took her a moment to realize that he must have seen something entirely different than she had. But if she asked him what he had seen, she'd have to tell him what she saw. Ronan was staring at them, raw, as if he knew what had happened in the tree, even without attempting it himself. A few feet away in the cavity, Gansey's head was bowed. He looked like a statue in a church, his hands clasped in front of him. There was something very ancient about him just then, with the tree arched over him and his eyelids rendered colorless in the shadows. He was himself, but he was something else, too. That something that Blue had first seen in him at the boy's reading, that sense of otherness, of something more, seemed to radiate from that still portrait of Gansey enshrined in the dark tree. Adam's face was turned away, and now, Blue knew
what his expression was. Shame. Whatever he had seen in his vision in the hollowed tree, he was certain Gansey was seeing it too, and he couldn't bear it. Gansey's eyes flicked open. "What did you see?" Blue asked. He cocked his head. It was a slow, dreamlike gesture. Gansey said, "I saw Glendower."
24.
As Adam had warned, it had not taken 2 seconds to explore the raven cut into the ground, follow the creek into the woods, watch the fish change colors, discover a hallucinatory tree, and return to Helen. According to Gansey's watch, it had taken 7 minutes. Helen had been furious. When Gansey told her that 7 minutes was a miracle and really they should have been gone 40, it had caused such an argument that Ronan, Adam, and Blue had removed their headphones to allow the siblings to duke it out. Without the headphones, of course, the three of them in the rear seat were robbed of the power of speech. It should have created an awkward silence, but instead it was easier without words. "It's impossible," Blue said the moment the helicopter had left the lot quiet enough to speak. "Time couldn't have stopped while we were in the woods." "Not impossible," Gansey replied, crossing the parking lot to the building. He ripped open the door to Monmouth's first floor and shouted up into the dim stairwell, "Noah, are you home?" "It's true," Adam said. "According to leyline theory, time can be a fluid thing right on the line." It was one of the more commonly reported effects of ley lines, especially in Scotland. In Scottish folklore, there was a long-held myth that travelers could be pixie-led or led astray by territorial fairies. Hikers would set out along a straight trail only to find themselves inexplicably lost, standing in a location they had no recollection of walking to, yards or miles away from their starting point, their watch showing minutes before or hours after they'd left, like they tripped on a wrinkle in space-time. The ley line's energy playing tricks. "What about that thing in the tree?" Blue asked. "Was that a hallucination? A dream?" "Glendower. It was Glendower, Glendower, Glendower." Gansey couldn't stop seeing it. He felt excited or scared or both. "I don't know," he said. He pulled out his keys and swatted Ronan's hand away when he snatched for them. It would be a cold, cold day in a Virginia summer when Ronan was allowed to drive his car. He'd seen what Ronan did to his own car, and the idea of what he'd do with a few dozen more horsepower at his command was unthinkable. "But I intend to find out. Come on, let's go." "Go? Where?" Blue asked. "Prison," Gansey said agreeably. The other two boys were already jostling her toward the pig. He felt high as a kite, euphoric. "The dentist, someplace awful." "I have to be back by..." But she trailed off. "I don't know when. Sometime reasonable?"
"What's reasonable?" Adam asked, and Ronan laughed.
"We'll get you back before you turn into a pumpkin." Gansey was about to add Blue to the end of this statement, but it felt strange to call her that. "Is Blue a nickname?" Beside the Camaro, Blue's eyebrows got suddenly pointy. Hurriedly, Gansey added, "Not that it's not a cool name, just that it's unusual." "Weird ass." This was from Ronan, but he said it as he chewed absently on one of the leather straps on his wrist so the effect was minimized. Blue replied, "Unfortunately, it's nothing normal, not like Gansey." He smiled tolerantly at her. Rubbing his smooth chin with its recently assassinated chin hairs, he studied her. She barely came up to Ronan's shoulder, but she was every bit as big as he, every bit as present. Gansey had a sense of incredible rightness then, with everyone assembled by the pig. Like Blue, not the ley line was the missing piece that he'd been needing all these years. Like the search for Glendower wasn't truly underway until she was part of it. She was right like Ronan had been right, like Adam had been right, like Noah had been right. When each of them had joined him, he'd felt a rush of relief. And in the helicopter, he'd felt exactly the same way when he'd realized it was her voice on the recorder. Of course, she could still walk away. She won't, he thought. She has to feel it, too. He said, "I've always liked the name Jane." Blue's eyes widened. "Jane? What? Oh, no, no. You can't just go around naming people other things because you don't like their real name." "I like Blue just fine," Gansey said. He didn't believe she was really offended.
Her face didn't look like it had at Nino's when they'd first met, and her ears were turning pink. He thought possibly he was getting a little better at not offending her, although he couldn't seem to stop teasing her. "Some of my favorite shirts are blue. However, I also like Jane."
"I'm not answering to that."
"I didn't ask you to."
Opening the door of the Camaro, he pushed the driver's seat forward. Adam obediently climbed in the back. Blue pointed at Gansey.
"I'm not answering to that."
But she got in. Ronan retrieved his MP3 player from the BMW before getting into the passenger seat, and even though the pig's aftermarket CD player wasn't really working, Ronan kicked the dash until a loudly obnoxious electronic track came on. Gansey tugged open the driver's side door. Really, he should be making Ronan do his homework before Aglenby kicked him out. But instead, he shouted for Noah one last time and then climbed into the car.
"Your sense of what constitutes cool music is frightful," he told Ronan.
From the back seat, Blue shouted, "Does it always smell like gasoline?"
"Only when it's running," Gansey called back.
"Is this thing safe?"
"Safe as life,"
Adam shouted. "Where are we going?" "Gelato. Also, Blue's going to tell us how she knew where the ley line was," Gansey said. "We're going to strategize and decide what the next move is, and we're going to pick Blue's brain about energy. Adam, you're going to tell me everything you remember about time and ley lines. And Ronan, I want you to tell me again what you'd found out about dream time and song lines. Before we go back there again, I want to find out everything we can about making sure it's safe." But that wasn't what happened. What happened was they drove to Harry's and parked the Camaro next to an Audi and a Lexus, and Gansey ordered flavors of gelato until the table wouldn't hold any more bowls, and Ronan convinced the staff to turn the overhead speakers up, and Blue laughed for the first time at something Gansey said. And they were loud and triumphant and kings of Henrietta because they'd found the ley line and because it was starting. It was starting.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.